everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and we have a special guest today, as always, an interesting guest this time, Kenneth MacLeod. He's at the Binghamton University, which is part of the State University of New York system, and he's in the Department of Clinical Science and Engineering, but he's also a special position of Entrepreneurship and Innovation Partnerships. He's the director of that particular subsection. Ken, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. My first trip to El Paso, in fact.
Yes, we're very happy that you're here, and we would like to know, like we ask a lot of our guests, how did you get into science and entrepreneurship?
Well, those are two very different stories. I started out as an engineer in my first life. I was raised in Motown in Detroit, Michigan, and if you're decent at science and mathematics, you almost have to become an engineer in Detroit. And so I took that path and ended up working for General Motors in the 70s and went through the oil crisis, the first oil crisis in 73, and had a profound effect on the industry, not perhaps as bad as the 2007 recession, but it was pretty serious, if you might recall. So they started restructuring and thinking about their manufacturing processes and how do we start moving towards smart machines? How do we develop machine vision, machine intelligence to build a better product?
Yeah, but we'll get to that.
Okay, shortly. Okay.
But we want to know when you were 11, 12.
I actually have an answer to that question. My father was a skilled tradesman working for General Motors, and GM had a suggestion program. And the 50s were not very pleasant economic times. And so a lot of 6-hour days, 4 days a week type schedules for people working in the plants. And they had the suggestion program. And my father was incessantly putting in suggestions. And I'd say, Dad, where do you get these ideas? He goes, just pay attention. You know, when people start complaining, something's wrong, look around, figure out a better way to do it. And he would put in 2 or 3 of these a day. And in fact, it kept us alive. It kept food on the table. It gave us a Christmas. And I was so intrigued by this ability to create ideas, to create things.
You mean he got a bonus?
He got a bonus. You get a bonus. If they use the idea, the suggestion, he would get a bonus. And I think from a young age, that really intrigued me, that the idea of, you know, creating things out of your mind, that maybe we could do it this way. He didn't actually have to build the prototypes or anything. He would just say, let's do it this way instead of this way, and somebody else would run with the idea. So I think that's where it started from. I think I got it from my father.
Do you remember any ideas that you had that weren't implemented that you thought were terrific at the time?
I would say almost all of my ideas that I thought were terrific at the time didn't get implemented because they turned out to be terrible ideas.
Well, give us an example of one of them.
I'll give you a fairly recent one. I developed a technology called vibromyography, and it's the ability to non-invasively measure muscle force, which is pretty important because muscles, frankly, about half the time people go to doctors, they have muscle pain, musculoskeletal pain. And so the ability to know if you're using your muscles correctly seems like a really important issue. And we, in fact, took the technology and developed it for a specific application for knee pain. So knee pain is incredibly common. And so 90-95% of the time you have knee pain, it's because you're using your knee incorrectly. So there's pathologic pain, there's physiologic pain. Physiologic pain is you put your hand in the fire and your hand hurts. And you don't say, what's wrong with my hand, right? You go, what's wrong with me? And you take your hand out of the fire, the pain goes away. If you leave your hand in the fire, you will burn your hand and now you have pathologic pain. And until your hand heals, that pain's going to be there. And it may be there after your hand heals. So that's pathologic pain. Our view was, boy, if we could just measure the muscles controlling the knee, show people how they're using their knee incorrectly, give them some exercise, they can correct their musculature, all the pain's going to disappear. We can treat 90% of knee pain. And that idea went absolutely nowhere. Nowhere. Nobody wants
because
to do the exercise.
Because it's fundamentally inappropriate or because
nobody wants to do the exercise. They go, but I could have surgery to fix. I go, well, it's not – there's nothing wrong with your knee. It's a fascinating thing. So having an idea, having a technology is a tiny aspect of having a viable business, a product that people will actually pay for.
How does that technology work? It sounds like a brilliant idea to me.
I thought so, too. I mean, I think the inventor is a brilliant guy, all right?
it's not instituted anywhere?
It's patented. It's been licensed by a company, and they're struggling with it. But so the way it works is it picks up the vibration. So when your muscles contract, they don't just contract at a constant force. There are these small micro vibrations that develop, and you can pick those up on the surface of the skin. And so we take those and we use a technique called wavelet packet analysis to extract out. So think of it. Do you guys, are you musicians? Can you read music? You're familiar with music?
I can, yeah.
Okay. So think of a musical score, and when you look at it, you have a scale that goes up, down, which is basically frequency, and on the x-axis is time. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
Music is a form of time frequency analysis. And so that's essentially what wavelet packet is. It's time frequency analysis.
Yeah.
We use time frequency analysis to pull out this information that we can then put into a genetic algorithm that teaches us how to record force from that data.
Tell us one of the simple but excellent ideas that your father put forward.
Oh, one of the
did he come home one day and say, "Guys, do you know what? I just got a bonus because of."
Oh my goodness! This is 50 years ago. I don't know if I can remember any of them. I remember there was one that he worked at a transmission plant in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And one of them was how they were stacking the transmissions when they were loading them onto the railroad cars. And he suggested an alternative packing mechanism, which meant that they could put on 20% more, I don't know, 15,
right.
20% more transmissions into a railroad car, which saves a huge amount on shipping. And so I remember that one. And that was one of the big hits.
That's great.
We had an amazing Christmas that year. Yeah.
So you studied as an engineer first when you left high school, and then tell us what you concentrated. When you began your own career, what was the sort of focus of your work and your research?
So I wasn't a researcher. I was an engineer working for General Motors, and I worked in the all companies, I guess, can be divided this way, but GM is divided into product division and production division. So I was an engineer on the production side, so making the equipment that made the car. So that's what I did. I did control panels. It was an exciting time because controls were all relay-based in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then we started transitioning to computer-based control systems. And so I was entering the field right at that critical time when microprocessors and mini computers were coming out. So it was a very exciting time to be in controls.
Did you ever have a thought about how computer control affected the job force?
Subsequently, I've become an avid reader of The Economist. I'm very interested in economic development. And now is a very difficult time, for example, for young people. Something like 50% of college graduates are unemployed or underemployed. So now it consumes me, basically, those kind of issues. But no, I would say at the beginning of my career, I wasn't relating automation, because you hear all the stories that, yes, automation displaces a group but creates new jobs for a whole different group of people. But it's pretty shocking now. You walk into an auto plant now. Last time I was in an auto plant, I saw one person on the plant floor.
Yeah,
it was amazing. The plant I used to, first started right out of high school working at Hydromatic, they employed 7,500 people a shift. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, it's two.
Yeah. So it really has changed a lot. But not then. No, not when I was a kid. I didn't think
about
those.
So your career started then as an engineer in industry.
How
did you transition then into being at Binghamton?
So this gets back then to the story I started out talking about at an inappropriate time during introductions. And I was working for General Motors, and they're looking to develop intelligent machines. So not just machines that did what you told them to do, but in fact could do smart work, do work that a human would normally be required to do, whether that be visual inspection or diagnostics, whatever the case may be. So they packed me off, sent me off to MIT to study machine intelligence. And in the 70s, the idea in machine intelligence, so you could build an intelligent machine, you got to understand humans, because humans are intelligent, humans have vision, they have hearing. So we have to understand all this physiology to build a smart machine. And so I'm tossed as an electrical engineer. I think the last biology course I had was in ninth grade. I'm tossed into all these physiology courses, and I'm trying to understand vision, and I'm trying to understand hearing, and I'm trying to understand brain processes, cognitive processes. And it was just remarkably exciting. I think that, along the way, when I was a young adult, I had detached retinas, and that got me very interested in vision and understanding the eye. And so maybe I was primed for it a little bit. I've been deaf since I was a kid. How the auditory systems work and all the pieces of that and what was going on in my auditory system that wasn't working correctly made me think. So maybe I was primed to have a deep interest in physiology from the get-go.
Are you seriously deaf?
I'm pretty seriously deaf, yeah.
So
if I took my hearing aids out, I would not be able to hear you at all. So
that might be a blessing sometimes, of course, right? I was up in the mountains this weekend, and I was outdoors and almost got struck by lightning. I mean,
you didn't know the storm was coming in, or
well, you could see
it.
It was really strong.
It was
the first one. I mean,
yeah.
Then everybody got off. It was at the golf course, but I mean, there was no time at all between the flash and the thunder. It was right there,
yeah.
And I was scared. I got very worried.
Can you say that on radio?
Well, I just said it, but
they edited it. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, it was pretty effective.
So you can see his hair still standing up from the shock.
Right. What was Binghamton's interest in you after you'd done this
study? Okay, so then it's a kind of a torturous thing. So I'm at MIT, and I get out of MIT, and I taught there as a lecturer for 1 year teaching lab courses. And then I went to Tufts University, and my master's degree actually was in the field of neurophysiology. My PhD was in the field of electromagnetic interactions with living tissue. You might remember back in the 70s, 80s, a lot of concern about power lines and cancer.
Yes.
And all of that. Do you remember that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I was one of those people doing that work.
And what was the end result of that? Because I remember the scare. I remember even having a class of liberal arts students going out with meters to measure the magnetic field under power lines. And
right.
What finally became? Where
what finally became of that is none of that is terribly important. This is the wonderful thing about research, I think. The biggest concern that you should have in your home is that your power system is grounded to the your water lines and in the U.S. And if you're near a substation, all the return currents flowing through the ground, and they're flowing towards the substation. So they're beaming in on it. And if your house is in the path, all that current is going to jump onto your cold water line, run through your cold water line, and then jump out of your house again. And so if your house is grounded to your copper line in your basement, there can be serious current flowing in that copper line, which means be careful if you're doing plumbing. But as importantly, that's where you're going to see the biggest magnetic fields. So if you are, in fact, sleeping near a cold water line going through your house, you can get exposed to relatively high magnetic fields.
Well, what about the lines that then use plastic? Right,
because that's what they do now.
They use plastic now. You've got to ground in a different way.
Or yeah, you can go outside of your house, cut out the 3 feet of your water line, and put in a rubber pipe there. And that's what they do now. If you have a concern, that's really what came out of it. There are more concerns on farms. You're on a farm; it can be an issue because the cold water lines go to water troughs. The cow who's standing on wet ground puts his nose into the water trough. Next thing you know, you've electrocuted the cows. So we had a lot of issues with that, where on certain farms, production would just plummet, and they couldn't figure out why. And it's because the cows would quit drinking water. You can't make milk if you don't drink water.
Yeah, but were they properly roasted when they were electrocuted?
No, they're smart enough to pull their nose out, but then they're smart enough not to put their nose back in.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Russ Chianelli is here today, and we're talking to Kenneth MacLeod from Binghamton University. He's the director of the Clinical Science and Engineering Program and Entrepreneurship and Innovation Partnerships Program. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Imagine a water balloon traveling down a narrow pipe when suddenly a pole inside begins expanding, stretching the balloon, and slowing it down. This describes red blood cells in people with sickle cell disease.
Their red blood cells are sickle-shaped rather than normal donut-shaped discs. The misshapen cells are rigid, don't flow easily through blood vessels, stick together, and block blood flow, causing pain, anemia, and organ damage.
Millions of people around the world suffer from sickle cell disease with few treatment options, but a recent discovery could ease the severity of this disorder.
After studying 7,000 mice engineered with sickle cell disorder, researchers keyed in on a molecule called S1P, which was elevated. The molecule is generated by an enzyme called SPHK1.
The researchers tried inhibiting the enzyme to see if it would lower S1P levels. Not only were fewer S1P produced, the mice's symptoms were improved. Their red blood cells had less sickling and lived longer.
Healthy red blood cells live 120 days compared to sickled cells, which live just 10 to 20 days. That means the bone marrow can't keep up production, which leads to anemia.
These mice also had less tissue damage and inflammation. The researchers found the same results when they worked with samples of human sickle cells. SP1 has other roles in the body, so we'd have to see if inhibitors to SPHK1 can safely and effectively be used in humans.
Up to this point, the only cure for sickle cell disease is a bone marrow transplant, which is only available for a small number of people. Studies like these are needed to ease the burdens of sickle cell disease, which is a lifelong illness.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Kenneth McLeod from Binghamton University. Let's move away from electrocuting cows and get into this other sort of hat that you wear, entrepreneurship and innovation partnerships. Talk to the audience and Russ and I about what you're talking about there.
Well, this is very exciting. Maybe I'm nearing the end of my career, hopefully not, but you accumulate 60 years worth of knowledge and you probably want to try to give back to society. I was a graduate student in 1980 when the Bayh-Dole Act was passed. And the idea there is that faculty who develop technology can own that technology. The university can own it. Prior to that, if it was developed with federal funds, the federal government owned it. So nobody was going to take this technology and run with it because anybody else could grab it and run with it. So you had no competitive advantage. So after the Bayh-Dole Act was passed, academia really jumped into this whole innovation game of some sort. And so we did as well. The lab I was working with, we had this very cool little amplifier. We thought that everybody in the world wanted to buy one. And so we launched a company to build them, and the company crashed and burned because we knew nothing about business or entrepreneurship or anything. So, but I did get the bug. And so over the years, I've been fortunate to be able to launch a number of companies, in fact, about 12 companies, to produce reasonably, I think, innovative products. Some were not very successful, like the one we talked about, which we thought should be incredibly successful. And so you learn a lot from your failures. And I've had a lot of failures along the way and a few successes. And so I feel that probably puts me in a position to help young people not make as many failures as I made in my life. And so that's what I do now. I find young people because I think they desperately need help because it's just a terrible economy out there.
But on your own words, if they don't try and fail, they won't have learned very much.
Oh, there's plenty of
ways to learn.
Don't worry. Yeah, there's plenty of places to fail.
What is your successful product? What is the one thing that you can say, when I look back, or commercially, this has really taken off?
I think that the one historically, this goes back to the 90s, a company that to promote fracture healing. And I still do a lot of work in this area, but in the elderly, they have very poor blood flow into their extremities. And so if they fracture their foot or they fracture their tibia, it's not likely to heal. And if you develop a non-union, you become dysfunctional and you may end up with an amputation. And a lot of it is just because, in fact, the tissue is so cold. Cold tissue can't heal. So can you warm up the tissue? And the answer is yes, you can. And what we use is an ultrasound technology to warm the fractured tissue up to a point where in the absence of lots of blood flow, the tissue could heal. And so we could, you know, dramatically increase the healing rate in individuals who have fractured their wrist or fractured their ankle or their tibia, you know, usually parts far from the core of the body because your body tends to keep the core.
So this is like a heating tape or something like
that?
It
is a ultrasonic transducer, yeah. And it turned out to be very successful.
Great.
Very simple, but very successful. I mean, we have a similar product now, one of the spinoffs, which is directed towards hospital-acquired infections, which are huge.
Rampant.
Issue. Yeah. And so what happens? You go into the hospital for surgery. They lay you on a metal table. They set the thermostat at 65 degrees because the nurses and the physicians, they have hats on and masks on and gloves on and gowns on, and they're sweating like crazy. So at normal temperatures, so they cool the room down so they're comfortable, but you're going to be freezing. And your core body temperature drops below 36. Your immune system shuts off. Next thing you know, you have an infection. It's just because you're cold. That's what it is. I mean, so we have a technology now to keep patients laying on a table warm while they're surgery. So
we have an innovator and an entrepreneur expert around the table, Russell. So, Russell, why don't you ask a few questions that you're bursting
well,
to know?
Yes. There was a recent article called MIT Inc.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it was talking about how MIT was trying to work with companies as a new model. And the question really is, there's a lot of learning to be done between the interaction of universities and companies, big companies, little companies, startups, that makes the innovation process difficult.
There is. Not so much at an MIT, because MIT is a land-grant school. So it's like a University of Michigan or an Ohio or whatever, where they realize that their goal is to traditionally, of course, help agriculture and industry. So we exist to, in fact, help industry. I think as you get into universities that have more of a basic science, less of a pragmatic perspective, there can be this equivalent of a town gown type clash. But it doesn't exist in some schools, and that happens to be the school I went to. So I came out into the world thinking, if I'm working at a university, I should be creating products that are useful to mankind. I mean, it's fun to publish papers and it's fun to get grants. But if at the end of the day somebody says, what's your legacy, and you point to a stack of papers, I mean, how good are you going to feel at the end of the day?
Well, let me jump into that, because you've also got the students that you've trained that have then gone out and done different careers. And so it's not just that.
But it's nice to have some of your work make it to the people also, besides the stack of paper and the stack of students.
And there's a huge role for basic science. A lot of people love basic science. I mean, so all these parts are necessary. So I think there's parts of academia that doesn't get it. I think there are parts that definitely get it. I think it's easier at some schools than other schools. MIT happens to be one of the schools that
Continue with that a little bit, because here at UTEP, we have a lot of innovators here that have products that they're trying to commercialize based by basic science. How can you advise them to get the help they need so that they can move faster?
The way you posed the question was perfect. We have a lot of great innovative people, and innovation is about the people. It's rarely about the idea or the concept. If you talk to venture capitalists, they'll put different numbers on it. Some will say the idea is 1%. Of the venture, some may go as high as 10%. Nobody goes over 10%. So let's say 5% on average. 5% of a successful venture is going to be the idea. 95% is the team that's doing it. It's the people doing it, their ability to execute. And teams are able to execute when they have a passion for what they're working on, when they have aspirations to tackle a certain task, a certain challenge, when they have this vision of how the world could be. If the team has that, they will go through a series of what we call in the business pivots. Okay, that didn't work. Let me try this. It's very much like the process of science, the process of innovation. I'm going to try this. That didn't work. I'm going to try this. That didn't work. I'm going to try this. One thing that we often struggle with in academia is that we have a technology and we get wedded to a technology. And that can be a bit of a death wish, because successful ventures, it's combinations of technologies. So it's kind of like tying one hand behind your back. I have these two hands, but I can only use this one because the other one's behind my back. So if you have 10 technologies, think of all the permutations of 10 things. But if you say, no, but one of those you have to use, well, now you're down to 9 combinations. So you've gone from 45 possibilities to 9 possibilities. So when you're trying to build a venture, a product around a technology, it can be very risky. So one of the things we help young people with is don't wed to a technology. Wed to a vision. What are you trying to do? And use technology is developed around the world. It's all accessible. You can license any of it. Everybody wants their technology licensed. Find what works and then do these combinations of disparate ideas. Innovation is simply a combination of ideas. That's all it is.
So at Binghamton, you have a series of classes, courses, or workshops or retreats for younger faculty coming in, especially those in science and engineering, to sort of begin to help that right from the beginning.
Mostly not science and engineering. They're the hardest group to convert. Artists get it immediately. Artists know that the point of life is to make meaning. You don't point at a painting or a sculpture and say, what do you do with that? They go, people look at that and they have all these emotions. I mean, that's what it's about. What we teach them is you're creating an experience. You know, what we're trying to create is unique user experiences. That's the goal. And artists just get it instantly. And so...
Yeah, but it's tough for them, too. You put your piece of art there, and, you know, the scientists put their data and said, here's my data, look, it's correct. Right. And they say, do you like this?
Oh, I'm not saying that they're going to innovate in the world of art. What I'm saying is if they kind of move into the world of entrepreneurship, this concept of the main thing is creating a user experience is already there. Where the engineers and the scientists, you have to teach them it's not about the technology. It's not about the science. It's not about the math. It's about a user experience. And that's a very hard thing for them to learn.
So as the entrepreneurship in sort of residence at Binghamton, what can you point to and say, hey, here was something where I got involved with other people's clever ideas or my own, and we've really stimulated something very positive happening?
Okay. I had two young men, and I just said, it's really hard for engineers to get this, but I'm in the engineering school, so I see a lot of engineers. These two young engineers came to me, and in their design class, they had a sustainable engineering course, and an industry that is not sustainable, a big industry, a $1 billion industry in New York State, is skiing. And it is collapsing rapidly because of climate warming. So none of the resorts can stay in business, make money. And so they said, why can't we have indoor skiing? Can't we create indoor skiing? And
which
so,
they've had in Japan for years.
They even have it in England, for goodness sake.
They have it.
And so, right, so it's in Europe, okay, and it's in New Jersey.
But it's only 100 feet.
But yes, exactly. These guys have this wonderful vision. And the idea is that we have treadmills. They have this carpeting they developed in France that they lay on the slopes in the summer that you can ski down. Let's put this carpeting on a treadmill. You can ski for miles and miles. And now let's take these like Ocular Rift goggles, put them on a person, project Mont Blanc. Okay, now you can ski the 5-mile run down Mont Blanc. You're exhausted at the end. You've had this amazing skiing right. experience. There's no chance of flying into a tree. It's perfectly safe. It's a wonderful idea.
I mean, this applies to so many things, right?
Oh, yeah. It could be bicycling. It could be canoeing. It could be kayaking.
If you haven't got a girlfriend, it could be sex.
They have this venture now called virtual sports. And it's more than virtual. I think I should have them change the name because it's physical sports. I mean, you're exhausted at the end of the run. That's my job. Right. My job is to take these guys that come to me and I go, that is a beautiful idea. You're going to change the world and you're going to – this sport that was about to disappear is now going to thrive, first in New York State and then throughout the country and then maybe the world. The interesting thing about new technology is that traditionally – and by traditionally, I'm talking hundreds of years – it takes about 25 years before somebody figures out how to use a brand new technology. This is where universities struggle because they want to see their technology commercialized before it runs out of patent. The patents last 20 years, and the technology is going to be 25 years before someone figures it out. So there's a conflict there that is very difficult to resolve.
Well, here's a final question. We have beautiful startup teams here, student startup teams, that have been quite successful. They have everything. They have the team. They have the invention. And now the next step is go out and get somebody to fund them.
That's
right.
Can
you give them any hints for that?
Well, the way you get funded is to have revenue. And so my teams, I say, you have 3 months to get some revenue. Okay, and then you start growing that revenue. And there's a revenue growth rate that we point to, and it's called the VC growth rate. And it's roughly 10% a week.
So you're saying if they don't have any income, they shouldn't go out for money?
Correct. Correct. If you can't show that people care about this, we call this market validation. The market doesn't care about your idea, then there's no sense in chasing money. Once you show that the market cares about it and your revenue, it can be tiny numbers, $100, $110, $120, $130. People go, wow, look at this growing. Investors will get very excited.
You've got to have that growth curve.
You have to have that growth curve to get
investors
excited.
It's not just a static income. It's got to be continuing on.
It's all about that. It doesn't have to be big numbers. It has to be growing.
We've had a lot of fun here, Kenneth McLeod from Binghamton University, part of the great SUNY program. It would be nice to have you come back anytime you want to come back and talk to us about the development of your entrepreneurship. And Russell here is now going to rush out and try and find people to buy his technology as opposed to floating it out there. Right, Russell? You got to get income.
That's right. And he said only $7. Just show a growth curve.
Show a growth curve. That really is all it's about. Very good.
I'd like to thank the audience for listening, and we will be back next week.